And it's time now to turn to our feature tonight. Kind of, frankly, excited about this tonight. Excuse me. Reissue coming out on Black Friday of the Black Unity Trio. And this is a legendary free jazz record, if you will. Pressed 500 copies of it originally, and the record is pretty obscure. A little bit of my history with it, and then we'll start listening to some and then get into the interview segments here, too. I didn't know about the album until about 1981, and David Lee from Coda Magazine, a friend and writer friend, published an interview with cellist Abdul Wadood, and he mentions this album in the interview, which, by the way, has been, it will be reprinted via French writer Pierre Crapon, who also published a really great interview with Hassan Shihad that I did an interview with here tonight. It goes more in depth even than some of the stuff that we got into tonight. Highly recommend you looking it up. If you look up Black Unity Trio in The Wire magazine, you can find extensive interview. Also, soon to be published, if it isn't already, is an interview with the alto saxophonist Yusuf Mumin as well. And then they're going to reprint this David Lee interview from Coda magazine from 1980. Is going to come out too. So, and then Hassan Razak, another Cleveland musician, has just published a interview and memory memoir sort of the Black Unity Trio and history in Cleveland. So a lot of information's coming out with the release, which is really great. I wanted to comment too that this album is remastered, and really great care has been taken to reprint it. So often some of these obscure records get bootlegged and things like this, and so this record is a legit reissue. All the members are still alive. This is a 52-year-old album. They are receiving money for this, and it's a landmark album that, unfortunately, most people have never had a chance to hear. As I mentioned, it's sort of, I would say, in line with a lot of the ESP-type records that were being produced. You know, Albert Eiler, Charles Tyler came out of Cleveland, and this is a band that came out of Cleveland in the late 60s. I think the reason this record is cherished, if you will, is because it's really diverse. The musicianship is extraordinary, and the music kind of goes from serene to energy to, you know, just great interplay, great listening. I can kind of go on and on talking about this, but it's a cool release, and we'll get into this interview here shortly. Let's hear a piece. This is a track that through the years I've grown to really fond of and have listened to multiple times. It's the closing track called Final Expression. Thank you. It's the closing track to our feature album tonight from the Black Unity Trio called Final Expression. Yusuf Mumin on alto saxophone, Abdul Wadud on cello, and Hassan Shihad on drums. And I had a chance to interview Hassan Shihad in October about the upcoming reissue of this. It's quite an extensive interview, which unfortunately I had to take a lot out because I'm trying to feature the music as much as possible here. And so we're going to get to more cuts, a couple more cuts from the record here in a short bit. I did mention that the album has extensive liner notes, and Hassan got in great depth talking about his history growing up in Birmingham, Alabama, and his father, musician, well-known musician there. And I thought I'd just read from a paragraph from the liner notes from the reissue written by Ross. Moshe Burnett says, Hassan was born on the 12th of March, 1944, in Montgomery, Alabama, and raised in the Magic City of Birmingham. He's the son of Amos Gordon Sr., who performed with the legendary Fess Watley at Industrial High School, now known as Parker High School, where the latter taught printing and played music on the side. Watley was the earliest and most influential band leader in Birmingham, mentoring many young musicians in the jazz idiom, such as Herman Sonny Blount, later known as Sun Ra, Erskine Hawkins, of Tuxedo Junction fame, were the elder of Gordon's fellow students at the same high school. Mr. Gordon Sr. evolved into become one of the first chair alto saxophonists with Lucky Millinder, Bull Moose Jackson, Andy Kirk, Louis Armstrong, and Erskine Hawkins, and small combos, among others. So, and that's just kind of touching the surface of some of the things we talked about. But to kind of stick with the Black Unity Trio here, I'd like to turn now to some sort of kind of background on Hassan, and then we'll spin another track and just kind of keep it moving along here.
Al Fatiha,
that's what I thought. Okay.
Al-Fatiha is the first book or chapter of the Quran. This is the verse that's recited in the five prayers a day over 35 times a day by Bean and a Half People. Translation, it either means the opening or the beginning.
Okay, cool.
I was backing up this woman, Laura Washington, who had this hit record called I've Got a Right to Court Cry, at 12 years of age.
Uh-huh.
I started playing at 12. I remember the bartender on the break came and asked me what did I wanted to drink. My father said, no, he doesn't drink yet. No. So I started playing at a very, very young age. What really stimulated the whole thing, my father was an elk. He wasn't a Mason. This is a social organization that most of the school teachers and musicians belonged to in Birmingham. He started around 57, 58, 59, an Elk Youth Jazz Band. Give you a little history about that. Out of this band, it was about 12 members in the band. 10 out of the 12 members became professional musicians. There's an album you might have heard of that Pierre in Paris is just feast. I sent you something about he's on the 70s now as far as these self-determination produced albums by black musicians.
Mm-hmm.
The brother on there by the name of Jothan Callens.
Yeah, I have an album by him,
okay,
yes.
Okay, Winds of Change.
Yeah.
I gave Jothan his first job.
Uh-huh, cool.
He's one of the people that were in this jazz band. Arthur Doyle, that we just spoke about, that cut the last album on Pierre's thing called Alabama, he was a member of this band. One of the baddest, I mean, awesomest trombone players I've ever heard in my life to this day. Graduated from Central State University in Ohio. Charles Stevens played with Lyle Sun Ra, did a lot of work with the Latin bands in New York. This brother was unbelievable. They happened to be, on one occasion, the last gig that we played at Oberlin before Abdul moved to New York, we brought them in from New York. I don't know why we didn't record this, because the concert was blistering, brother, blistering. But Arthur Doyle and Charles Stevens played with the Black Unity Trio at the last concert that we did at Oberlin College. Mm-hmm. When I graduated from high school, trying to please my mother, bless her soul, I went to school in Washington, D.C. at Howard University. Instead of me being a music major concentrated in music, I went to high school, Howard University, lying to myself that I wanted to be a lawyer. Yeah, ain't that a trip? Anyways, I met Kwame Ture, Stokely Carmichael, you familiar with?
Yes.
Okay, Stokely and I became best of friends. I was there the night they conceived the whole SNCC organization.
Uh-huh.
Okay, in 1964, I left Howard. Of course, to show you how things were not going in my way at that time. I left Howard in the spring, in May of 64. Guess who took over the music department at Howard that fall? Donald Byrd.
Oh, wow, cool. Okay, a little bit, some highlights there from some of the Hassan Shaheed's background. Now we're going to turn to, he moved to New York and hooked up with a vocalist in a group, and then moved to Cleveland with the band. And he sort of talks about getting into Cleveland, getting a drum set back when he was a little bit older here, and then how the Black Unity Trio came about and him settling in Cleveland. Which Cleveland is the origin place of the Black Unity Trio.
I didn't have a set of drums because I didn't go to New York to play.
Right.
But after I withdrew from the new school, vocalist, she's deceased now, very fine vocalist. She's in the jazz, Alabama Jazz Hall of Fame, by the name of Countess Felder, came to New York. I don't even remember how we got together, how we found uh-huh. each other. But she was living in Cleveland. She and her husband
okay.
were just there.
So
for,
is that how you made the connection with Cleveland then? And
And she had signed a 2-3 month contract with the major hotel in Cleveland down on the lake. And she asked me if I would be interested in moving to Cleveland to fulfill this contract. So it wasn't anything happening in New York for me at that time. As I said, I didn't even have a drum set. So she took me to Cleveland, my wife and myself, put us up in her house, and bought me a set of drums. I didn't even have a set of drums.
Uh-huh.
That's the same drums that you hear on Al Fatiha.
Okay.
It's a drum set that she bought me.
Cool.
Okay. So Countess is out one day shopping up on 127th and Superior in East Cleveland. There's a big window front on this little small, cozy, what was a record shop. The name of the record shop was Cosmic Music. She peeps in the window and sees Sun Ra, first of all, up there, Albert Isler, Charles Tolliver, I think that's his name, Noah Howard, I believe. But anyway, it was the entire, you familiar with the old ESP label?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so it was the entire ESPL category at that time. She goes in, Joseph, is the owner of the record shop.
Okay.
So they get to talking, and she and her husband, like myself, we were very, very, very much in the John Coltrane, and that didn't happen when we came to Cleveland.
Mm-hmm.
We were Coltrane fanatics before we got to Cleveland. So they got to talking, the conversation, and finally Yusuf told Countess that he had a good friend, which was a heck of a celloist, and they were trying to put a group together, and they were looking for a drummer. So Countess proceeds to tell him, well, my dear friend is here that's living with me now that I just brought in from New York, who is a drummer, who is a Coltrane, new music, cosmic music. I don't like the term avant-garde. But anyway, a musician who would love to, you know, to hear what you're playing and possibly playing with you. So she went back to the house and got me, put the drums in the car, went up there. The brother locked the door. We went in the back behind the record display. Abdu Wadu was there. In the meantime, he had called Abdu Wadu. He'd come up with his cello. I set the drums up. We started playing. So you've heard the term used so many times, love at first sight.
Right.
This was here. Love. Hearing at first. I mean, as soon
right.
as we hit the tune. And I know we'll forget, Yusuf, after we finally, we played about 30 minutes, man. I'm talking about nonstop blistering. Nothing, I mean, out there, way out. Never had played together before.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But so Yusuf at the end say, well, Abdu, what do you think? Abdu, what do? Say, yeah, man, yeah. That was the beginning.
Uh-huh. Cool.
That was the beginning, just that simple situation. You have a question. Thank you.
the opening track to the Black Unity Trio album, Al Fatiha. We're featuring it tonight, soon to be reissued within the next week. Originally came out on the Salaam record label and reissued on the same label, but pressed by Gotta Groove Records in Cleveland. And a little bit later on here, we'll give you information on how you can run a copy of the album down if you're inclined. Anyway, that was the opening cut, and I played from the reissue there, and sound quality of the reissue is fantastic. They went back into the original tapes and did a really high-end job of pressing the record and taking care at every level to reproduce this, and so there's just certain sounds that are fuller and more revealed than from the original record. It's quite a treat it's kind of a reissue done correctly. I think this is important too myself because I've heard like Bob Marley records that were printed really crummy. You know, they come out and you're paying a lot of money for a reissue thinking you're getting something special, and they're using MP3 files or something to reprint the record. And this isn't the case with this one. It's very, very well done, and it's cool because it's such a iconic, obscure, great album from the 60s. Sort of a timeless record and also a timepiece, sort of a statement of the 60s somehow, capturing the certain essence of that era. Okay, so we've been in conversation here with Hassan Shaheed, and I want to get back to another section of the interview here. Again, it was a real extensive phone call, and so I've pieced things together here. I hope, you know, the flow of this is coming across really well, so you can kind of follow along here. So we're kind of at the stage here where still talking about pre-album release of the Black Unity Trio.
Before leading up to the record, man, we were playing, I'm very proud to say, we never played in a nightclub. Never.
Uh-huh.
Never. We had the whole idea of doing what they had been doing, because Dad had played some colleges with Louis Armstrong all over the country.
Uh-huh.
Okay. We had the idea of doing college concerts, because we were smoking at that time. Okay, so before we finally decided to record this, we must have played together for like 3-4 hours a day for maybe 6-8 months, almost a year.
Uh-huh.
So we were so tight at that point, Mike. A simple example would be, if I hear you playing bass and you said, bop, bop, da, da, bop, what the hell you think the next thing is going to be?
Yeah, right. Dot, dot.
Bop, bop.
Yeah, right.
So we had got to the point where if I hear chromatic, ascending or descending chromatic, I knew every place on my drums and cymbals that I could play something harmonious to what the melody was or whatever you want to call it.
Uh-huh.
What actually locked us in very good, especially with mallets, as you know, bass is tuned in fourth, cello is tuned in what, fifth?
Fifth, yeah.
My drums were tuned in a pentatonic scale.
Uh-huh, cool.
So it blended.
Right.
You could hear things that we did. We were that close where we could play anything that we want to, not in a harmful way, but we actually were convinced, and it's a difference, Mike, between being arrogant and confident.
Right.
We felt we could knock a plane out the sky. You will hear something on the back of the album if you got a good copy with some earphones. It's at the end or maybe in the light of blackness or whatever it is.
Uh-huh.
That we close out this tune, and you can hear a sound on there like,
uh-huh.
Nobody, including the engineer, is responsible for that sound. Something that we were trying to do, just like the Africans do, and all good musicians like to do if they've really proven, we had drawn a spirit down. Now, people are going to think I'm crazy. We had drawn a spirit down in the studio, and they were having a conversation, and the tape caught it.
Uh-huh.
So we started doing college concerts when we were able to scrape up enough money. And the last money we did this concert live at Western Reserve is the way we came up with the $500 to get the first 500 albums.
Uh-huh.
Do you know what it cost to press 500 albums in 68?
No, I don't.
$500.
Uh-huh. Cool.
A buck a watt.
Yeah.
So when we got the albums, man, we didn't really know what we hadn't had that part planned out. That's why most of the record companies that you see that Pierre talking about, even probably Charlie Mingus and Max Roach. So you come up with this grand idea about doing this and all the beauty involved in the self-determination. But you have to see, people don't plan to fail, they fail to plan.
Right.
So most of these people that did these record companies, I don't think really thought out, how am I going to distribute these albums and sell them and get paid?
Right. And it frankly, the whole system, even to this day, doesn't promote creative music hardly at all.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's just
and
horrid.
The
yeah.
bigger companies, quite naturally, especially with Charlie Mingus and Max Roach, blackballed the black companies.
Right.
And see, they didn't have any European contacts like I have now.
Right.
By the grace of the contact came to me. I didn't generate it. Okay.
Uh-huh.
So what we did when we got the 500 albums, we went right back to the same brother who was over the Black Studies Department at Western Reserve, who had hired us to do this concert live. And we said, man, would you possibly have any information on the other black arts society or black societies at other colleges? He just happened to have a whole directory of those type organizations.
Mm-hmm.
So what we did was we gave away a copy and sent a copy of the album and an introductory letter to every black student assigned there on the East Coast and Midwest, because we weren't thinking about going to California that much at
uh-huh.
that time. You know what I mean?
Right, yeah.
Out of this is how we started to get jobs at these colleges at a fee that no club owner ever would have paid us, especially in Cleveland or New York.
Right. Up next, we're going to hear another cut from Black Unity Trio, a track called In Light of Blackness.
Thank you.
Fade that cut into the background there, In Light of Blackness from the Black Unity Trio, our feature album tonight, and recorded back in 1968. Up next, I'm going to return here to the another interview segment with drummer Hassan Shahad, and this is a section where he talks about, you know, that, you know, it's been 52 years since the album came out, and then he gets into a discussion about another cut I'm going to play in a little bit called John's Vision. And then rather than go right into John's Vision, I wanted to play a couple excerpts here from, we were talking about drums and the, you know, the performance, and I wanted to include some of his discussion about drumming so that we could, you know, you could listen to a cut and maybe think about some of the things that were mentioned in terms of the drumming while you're listening to the next cut here. So I'm going to carry on here.
A few minutes ago about the album, one thing that I think is phenomenal about it is exactly 52 years of age, approximately. We cut this album December 24th, 1968.
Uh-huh.
It didn't get released locally, I mean, Cleveland, until 69 and other parts of the country by 1970. That's why a lot of people that do research on it have that year as the release date. The music, briefly, what's so phenomenal about the album, Mike, is that if you were to put it on right now, and it's 52 years of age, it does not age.
Agree.
It'll sound just like it was cut yesterday. That's how far ahead. And again, now, it's the difference between arrogance and confidence. That's far ahead the creator, not us. Because, Mike, any one of us will tell you, when we start playing, the spirit will take you over, Mike. I'm telling you, I'm sitting there looking at my hands and feet. It ain't me playing, because I ain't that bad, man.
Uh-huh.
This was spirit was playing me, man. And we had that in our hearts, that we were in the right place at the right time, doing exactly what the Creator had predestined us to do. Now, a little bit about the music, if I may talk a second about the tunes.
Yes, that'd be great.
What we actually, with no disrespect to the father of all of this, which I look at as being John Coltrane,
mm-hmm.
my greatest mentor. I met him in 66 backstage at the Village Theater and couldn't believe it. Most humble cat I ever met in my life. The tune that I'd like for you to play, Your Decision.
Yeah, yeah.
John's Vision.
Yeah, that was high on the list.
All of these tunes were actually written by Abdul and Yusef doodling around. They had these tunes together when I came in. We did another one that we'd never recorded, like West Pakistan, that I did the rhythm things to. But anyway, Yusef has the right to express to the world why or what this tune meant to him, as I have the right to express what it meant to me. Yusef said that it had something to do with John the Baptist being in prison on this island. I can't think of the name of it now. I think this comes out the Bible, mm-hmm. which all of this came out of the Nation of Islam teaching, which he was a part of, great organization at that time. Mm-hmm. It went a little haywire, but I'm not going to get into that. What it meant to me when I first heard it and he told me what the name was, this was John's vision. What we were saying on John's vision is, this is what John saw.
Mm-hmm.
And if you listen at it, man, if you listen at it, you can hear John. Now, when you turn the album over on the tune Birth, Life, and Death, on the tune Birth, Life, and Death, we honestly felt in our hearts, with no disrespect to John, that this was what was going to happen after Train.
Mm-hmm.
Personal observation.
Mm-hmm.
When Train passed, man, it's like everybody got scared. Personal opinion. Somebody's going to hear this and say, oh, man, I don't know what he was talking about. He ain't nobody. He ain't never been to New York. The hell was going to New York, man? You know, it was about the music.
Yeah, so many. So
when Train died, the musicians got scared. The labels didn't want it. The clubs didn't want it. So it sort of disappeared and went underground, whatever you want to call it.
Right. I'm going to move ahead here to another segment of the interview with drummer Hassan Shahid and talking about drums. And then we're going, after a couple of those segments, I'm going to get into the track John's Vision that he mentioned.
What I was trying to do with the music, instead of just being a metronome, I was trying to keep the momentum going. Number one.
Right.
Number two, do something harmonically along with the cello or the alto, soprano, bass, clarinet, by knowing where I could hit my cymbal, my bass drum, my two floor tom toms, my tom tom on the drum, and my snare.
Mm-hmm.
I could play ba da dee da dee five no ba da dee da dee. That's pentatonic. That's what my drums were saying. Okay, the cymbals were saying da 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 da.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew where I could hit it in a certain manner, close to the bell, where it's thicker,
mm-hmm.
and flatten it. If you get my drift.
Yeah, right.
Now, this sounds like I'm crazy, man.
No. I play music.
What I was trying to do was combine the two, because what I observed when I heard Train, he had Pharoah, Ellis, Rashid, Jimmy Garrison, and a conga player. So that's 4, 5 cats.
Mm-hmm.
Train, so you can push that element of rhythm and melody and sound all together, where you compact it and it explodes just like the splitting of an album. So when you got 5 people concentrating on this, it's square roots. So Train's 5 sounded like 25 mm-hmm. people playing. What we had mastered by the grace of the Creator with the trio is that same effect, where it sounded like it was 9 people on stage, and sometimes it was,
mm-hmm.
because the spirits were there. all the rhythm things that the new drummers were doing that was perfected by Elvin. But again, that's a good point you made, because Elvin's polyrhythm thing, not like Rashid and the cat that was with Cecil Taylor, Andrew Surreal, Elvin had a bounce polyrhythm thing, which fit in perfectly. I give you a tune, the tune Train did, Out of This World.
Right, yeah, great song.
Go back and listen to that, and you hear Train, you hear Dale just boom, dang, just yeah, dang, right, yeah. Dang, boom, bang, dang. Okay, so all that is one of the 27 rudiments, which is called a paradiddle.
Right.
You can play a single and a double. But what I was doing was, I've always been conscious of everything, Mike, that I could play with my hands, I could play with my feet.
Mm-hmm.
I can play paradiddles with my feet.
Mm-hmm.
But what took me some time to master was, I got a right foot that I'm playing bass drum and a left hand that's accenting on the snare is to play a paradiddle between my foot and my hand.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm playing a paradiddle with my right hand and my sock cymbal.
Okay.
You understand?
Right,
and this is what, see, with us out having a bass, you know, like,
Right.
A lot of people got groups that just had a bass and let the piano, because the piano, in a sense, does sort of lock you in, and the bass can lock you in. But see, without us having a bass, one thing that gave that propulsion, I think, that you were talking about, is that I never used my sock as the metronome. What do I mean by that?
Yeah, I hear
the sock
you.
Hits two and four. That's
right.
Just like black folks clamping and clapping,
right.
Hitting the foot. You understand?
Right.
See, I used to watch when they first start videoing these big concerts with these rock bands. I see the people in the audience clapping on the beat, bop, bop, instead of bop, syncopate, bop. And Wynton Marsalis did a beautiful story about that once. He said most of the European music had a military rhythm.
Right.
You understand what I'm saying?
Right.
You know, where the other folks staying with right. Okay, so without having the bass player to stick me into a Jimmy Garrison pattern, I could flutter my sock cymbal.
Right.
And that helped with the propulsion.
And Abdul Wadud was such a killer arco player that he was bowing a lot, and that changes the texture underneath too.
And you've never seen him, have you?
No, I never have, no.
Brother,
yeah,
we had an Alabama spider that we called a granddaddy spider, who had a small body but long legs. His hand looked like spider web. He could really do a triple stop. You know what he sounded like to me, honestly, Mike? The Spanish guitarist Segovia.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, okay, cool. Yeah.
That's what he sounded like to
me.
Yeah. And see, under all of that combustion that was going on, he talks about this in the Coda Magazine interview.
Right, yeah.
He didn't use a microphone.
Right.
That kid could be heard over all the combustion without, and I'm talking about while we doing all of that fluttering and stuff, he would always be the one who was singing, man. And all of that was locked into that. And when you put all of that together and everybody's minds becomes one, you start square rooting the sound and the effect.
Interview with drummer Hassan Shihad. And we're going to go to the top of the hour information here. And then I'm going to come back to and I'll introduce another track from the album here. So I'll be back in a moment.